This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Gazelle Full Circle Resale. Now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
And coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in Ashland, Oregon last night, the offices of radical publisher Michael Rupert were ransacked. University officials in Colorado say they're firing Ward Churchill, and the cumulative budget for the so-called war on terror has tripled to $17 billion.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,520 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, and IraqBodyCount.org reports that 42,889 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. The website informationclearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate is as high as 250,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 26, 2006. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. The KBOO News has learned that the offices of Michael Rupert, founder and editor of From the Wilderness, newly relocated to Ashland, Oregon, were burglarized last night. Several computers were reportedly destroyed, and a police investigation is proceeding. Rupert says the office is shut down, and there will be no updates at present and no email traffic. Rupert came to prominence when, as a Los Angeles police officer, he came forward to corroborate allegations that the CIA was dealing crack cocaine and funneling the profits to covert operations in the Middle East. Today, he continues to investigate and report on the so-called war on drugs, as well as peak oil and the 9/11 conspiracy. His popular website is still up. That's at FromTheWilderness.com on the web, but will not be updated on schedule at present. We'll keep you posted on any further developments.
Providence Health Systems in Oregon has settled a lawsuit that centered on its practice of charging uninsured patients a higher rate for care than it did insured patients. A Providence spokesman said 1,000 uninsured patients will get refunds or discounts on past hospital bills from the nonprofit hospital chain. Moreover, Providence, with 7 hospitals in the state, started giving discounted rates to uninsured patients as of the first of the year as part of the settlement. A lawyer for the plaintiff said the chief value of the Providence settlement is that the uninsured patients are going to Providence hospitals over the next 2 years are entitled to the same rates as insured patients. That could involve more than 40,000 patients and mean millions of dollars in reduced rates.
Olga Vivas, the executive vice president of the National Organization for Women, visits Portland tonight on a whistle-stop tour of the Pacific Northwest. KBOO News caught up with Olga this afternoon.
Yes, we're doing a tour of the Northwest, and tonight is Portland's evening. We're going to be talking about LGBT issues and also in connection with the current immigration debate. And now's position on the current immigration reform and how it interconnects with the issues of women, children, families, and trying to inform the our supporters and our members about the feminist position that we should be taking in this debate. This is our 40th anniversary as an organization. We are the largest civil rights organization, the oldest civil rights organization, second oldest, I should say, the first one being the NAACP. And we're very proud that now has been for 40 years advocating for the rights of women. Immigration, like almost every issue, affects women and children significantly. Half of the undocumented in the United States today living here are women and their children. And what we're really looking for is a comprehensive immigration policy process that is a path to permanent residency and citizenship for the undocumented in the United States, a path that is fair, that is doable, that is not punitive, that doesn't create a group of people divided into, like the current proposal in the Senate, dividing people into three different categories. We think that women in particular will benefit from being legalized, not only in wages, but women in particular are subject to exploitation. And we believe that immigration reform needs to include labor provisions for the undocumented and also a way for them to become legal.
That was Olga Vivas, Executive Vice President of the National Organization for Women. She speaks tonight at the Talking Drum Bookstore, 446 Northeast Killingworth Street, from 7 to 8:30 p.m.
Northeast Portlanders met with Police Chief Rosie Sizer last week, recounting personal experiences with racial profiling. It was the fifth of five community listening sessions held in response to a recent report that found minority drivers are pulled over at a higher rate than whites. Black drivers are stopped nearly twice the rate as white drivers, but when searched are less likely to have illegal drugs. Due to technical difficulties with the audio last week, the KBOO News replays the important piece of reporting by KBOO's Jacob Fenston.
On June 11th, my 19-year-old nephew, who is my adopted son, was chased by Portland police to our residence. I heard him calling my name. He calls me Paula, but I am his adopted mother. I heard him calling my name. I ran to him. I was in the basement coming up the steps. When I got there, he was in the control position on his knees. Taser pointed at him. I lost it. At that time, another officer came from the left and grabbed my arm and put me in some kind of position or some kind of twist or some kind of turn. The officer that had my son, my adopted son, my brother's son, said that he had chased him because he thought he had drugs. This is a boy that has no record. This is a boy that does nothing, very little of anything, except go to work. He was getting off of work. He had just got a new job. Anyway, I was written a citation for interfering with the police. My nephew was taken downtown. He was booked, fingerprinted, and let go because he didn't do nothing. That's all I got to say.
Paula West speaking to a group of about 80 Northeast Portland residents and police officers. She's one of 12 community members that offered personal testimonies about racial profiling. Police Chief Rosie Sizer said the police bureau is clearly not always succeeding in doing the right thing.
But we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Chief Sizer said that to protect the community, police must use controversial pretext stops. Traffic stops where an officer suspects illegal behavior and uses a minor infraction to pull someone over. A failure to signal or a broken taillight. Recently, such pretext stops have led to police shootings of innocent unarmed drivers. Chief Sizer says police need to find a way to conduct these stops that is safe and acceptable to the community.
You may hate pretext stops, but when those pretext stops are used to close a drug house next door to you, you're going to want us to use them. So how do we do it more finely with better results and with fewer negative results for all of you?
Testimonies, police officers and residents had the chance to talk face-to-face in small group discussions. Many community members said officers treat them disrespectfully when pulled over for minor violations. officers won't tell them why they've been pulled over.
Me, I'm the type of person that if I don't see anything I did, the first thing I'm asked is, you know, what is the problem, police officer? What did I do wrong? And oftentimes you find officers, they're already in a kind of like a mad mode. You know, it's like, how dare you ask me a question?
Officers agreed cultural differences and misunderstandings are part of the problem.
Move into the black neighborhoods. If you live around the black people and you have to be a part of the black community and you learn what the black people are like and what they're sensitive to and what they're not, then when you go into the profession, you are more culturally sensitive to their needs and their environment instead of just the image that is constantly being portrayed. So that's all I have.
Sessions were organized by Oregon Action and a coalition of community organizations. Oregon Action will compile the ideas generated through these sessions in a report they'll present to the City Council and Police Bureau. The report, due this fall, will include recommendations on steps to stop racial profiling. Chief Sizer said the Bureau doesn't need to wait for the report to begin making changes.
There are very immediate things that we can do about facilitating relationships between officers and communities of color. And that's a two-way street. We're going to need help in that. I think we can also make some changes to our training, because part of what I've heard repeatedly in these sessions is it's also about the quality of the contact when the contact is made.
In 2000, a Blue Ribbon panel was appointed to investigate racial profiling in Portland. The group produced a report recommending many of the same measures that were suggested last night, including better training and recruitment of minority officers. But after 6 years, it's clearly still a problem. Chief Sizer said the Bureau needs to make a more sustained effort at recruitment, and that training is something that can take a long time.
We have had training. We're going to continue to have training. It's part of it is we have to train people out of assumptions they make because you're an American, and that requires continuous effort for all of us.
But others said it may not be that difficult.
To solve the problem, I don't think it's rocket science. You treat me like you want to be treated.
That's right.
You treat me like you would want me to treat your son if I stop him. That's the way you stop it. We don't have to have no divine intervention. We can do this stuff. There's got to be a will.
I'm Jacob Fenston, KBOO News.
The labor union that represents about a third of the employees of the Eugene Water and Electric Board will go on strike on the 4th of July, assuming their demands on the utility are not met by then. The agency received a 10-day notice of intent to strike Friday morning from Local 659 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. The union says its workers would walk out at 4:30 p.m. July 4th if no agreement was reached on their three main issues: the cost of health care benefits, retroactive pay, and a paid holiday on Veterans Day. If a strike occurs, the agency says its top priority will be keeping the lights on and the water coming out of the tap for its customers. No new negotiating sessions have been announced.
In Aberdeen, Washington, the Public Utility District General Manager says a string of thefts involving a number of power poles and substations around Grays Harbor are costing the PUD thousands of dollars in copper wire and could jeopardize lives. On Friday, a Bonneville Power substation was broken into west of Olympia after burglars cut through a fence. Officials said the thieves are removing copper and aluminum ground wires from power poles and selling them as scrap metal. But the problem has become dangerous. That's because the copper and aluminum wires are on the poles there to ground electrical current in case the power line comes off the pole during a storm or during an accident. Without the ground wire, the power keeps emitting from the broken power line, endangering anyone who comes across it.
The 14th annual Good in the Hood Festival took place over the weekend at Northeast Portland's King School Park. The neighborhood festival attracts thousands of residents each year to celebrate the district's diverse cultures with food, music, and local vendors. Festivities started Saturday with a parade along Martin Luther King Boulevard. KBOO's Jacob Fenston was there and has this report.
T-I-T-T!
We're drilling. We're Greenwood drill. Stepping for Greenwood drill team.
Where do you go to school?
Women. Kellogg Middle School.
How long have you been doing this?
For a year or 6 months.
Yeah.
I think we've done it for 3 years.
Are you having fun at the festival so far?
Yeah.
We're looking forward to it. We're excited.
How's it going so far?
Good, very good. Nice turnout. The weather's beautiful.
Have you been a part of the Good in the Hood Festival before?
Oh, yes. This is like my 10th.
Yeah. I don't know how many years I've been in it, but yeah, quite some time now.
What are you doing out here at the parade today?
Supporting our community,
Asian community. We're from the Ergo and Asian Family Center. Asian Family Center helps immigrants and refugees that need help with to be more self-sufficient. So we do a lot of services. It's what like a candy store. You walk in, you can't stop. You help families with ESL classes and work employment. Students that need help with their homework, you know, we that's so much. There's more.
How many of there are you in your group today?
More than 20 right now.
More than 20, about 25.
How's it going so far?
It's very
hot,
good.
Very hot, and I'm hungry.
So what's your organization?
Eminent Ladies of Virtue Club. It's part of the Bilge Bridges program, and it's enhancing, for African-American young rites of passage program that enhances the youth to grow into their womanhood.
What group are you with?
Senseless Violence Leads to Silence. It's a nonprofit organization against violence.
And what do you do exactly?
We do a grief counseling in North and Northeast. We give annual marches, and our next march is September 9th. And we support the community against all the violence that's happening in our community.
You marching in the parade today?
Yeah, we signed up to march in the parade to support all the people, all the victims. Some of the people marching with us, like my son-in-law right here, he's a victim. He lost his wife, Asia Bell, 2 years ago in a shooting. So that's where the organization was founded from, through the tragedy of them too.
How's the day going so far?
It's a little stressful because we can't seem to find out where we're supposed to be, but God's going to make all that work out for us.
Why are you out here today?
To support the neighborhood, also to highlight education here in North and Northeast Portland and throughout Portland, and just to be a part of the overall festivities.
As commissioner of the city, I have my own entry, and I really spend a lot of time during the summer going to most all the neighborhood fairs and festivals. It's a great way for me to check in on what's going on in every neighborhood and gives folks an opportunity to ask me questions, and they're not afraid to shout their opinions out as I walk by as well.
That's City Commissioner Sam Adams, and this is Code Blues, a local band kicking off 2 days of live music, hot food, and fun with neighbors. Proceeds of the festival go to supporting community programs around the neighborhood. For KBOO News, I'm Jacob Fenston.
An Army sergeant from Rainier has been killed by an improvised explosive device in Iraq. The 21-year-old Sergeant Justin Dean Norton enlisted during his senior year at Rainier High School and was deployed to Iraq in November. He graduated from Rainier High School, where he played football and wrestled in 2003. Gary Warnock says a Fort Lewis sergeant told them Norton died when an IED went off outside of the patrol vehicle he was in the Baghdad area. Warnock said his stepson's unit was fired on and the soldiers got out to investigate when the IED hit. Warnock told the newspaper he did not know if anyone else died or if there was or was injured in the explosion. The U.S. Department of Defense has not yet confirmed the death.
The annual cost of replacing, repairing, and upgrading Army equipment in Iraq and Afghanistan is expected to more than triple the next year. next year to more than $17 billion, according to Army documents obtained by the Associated Press. Army and Marine Corps leaders are expected to testify before Congress tomorrow and outline the growing costs of the war, with estimates that it will cost between $12 billion and $13 billion a year for equipment repairs, upgrades, and replacements from now on. From 2002 to 2006, the Army spent an average of $4 billion a year in annual equipment costs. But as the war takes a harder toll on the military, that number is projected to balloon to more than $12 billion for the federal budget year that starts October 1st. The $17 billion also includes an additional $5 billion in equipment expenses that the Army requested in previous years, but has not yet been provided.
The former Secretary of State Colin Powell says he was dismayed on the misuse of national intelligence in the lead-up to the war to Iraq. A committee of Senate Democrats held investigative hearings today on the faulty intelligence claims. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Strong words by former Bush administration employees.
I was dismayed. Unquestionably, in my mind, our national leaders were using intelligence in a way that was not as discriminating as it should be. Let me put it that way.
Lawrence Wilkerson was the chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell during the lead-up to the war in Iraq.
The aspect of intelligence in general that disturbs me as a citizen, as a former soldier, is the politicization of that intelligence, what I would call and what the press has called cherry-picking or shaping the intelligence in new and unique ways in order to support political objectives. That's the part of the general comment that I would make about our intelligence community that disturbs me the most.
Wilkerson was referring to the intelligence on aluminum tubes said to be used for a weapons program, and even more so to provide the public with evidence that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's Iraq were closely aligned. A special unit was created just to find such evidence, Wilkerson said. Wilkerson was joined by three others who held key roles in the administration in pre-war Iraq. They testified before Senate Democrats on an oversight hearing on pre-war intelligence. Testimony in the hearing not only insisted that sketchy intelligence was misused, but post-war predictions were ignored. Paul Pillar was a national intelligence officer for the Near East and South Asia. He talks about a report of possible post-war problems that went ignored.
The intelligence community produced, on its own initiative, its assessment of the likely challenges there. It presented a picture of a political culture that would not provide fertile ground for democracy and foretold a long, difficult, and turbulent transition. It projected that a Marshall Plan-type effort, something on that scale, would be required to restore the Iraqi economy, despite the oil wealth. It forecast that in a deeply divided Iraqi society, there was a significant chance that the sectarian and ethnic groups would engage in violent conflict unless an occupying power prevented it. And it anticipated that an occupying force would itself be the target of resentment and attacks, including by guerrilla warfare, unless it established security and put Iraq on the road to prosperity in the very first weeks and months after the fall of Saddam. It also assessed that war and occupation would boost political Islam, increase sympathy for terrorist objectives, and make Iraq a magnet for extremists from elsewhere in the Middle East.
Witnesses said the White House was set on going to war with Iraq at the time of the Downing Street memo revealed such intent between Great Britain Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush in July of 2002. And Wilkerson says it was even earlier than that.
As we now know from subsequently reported discussions, very senior figures in the administration who were very much on the pro-war side were speaking of the overthrow of Saddam as an objective that's now become live in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 in September 2001.
He said the driving and undeterred force behind the policy was Vice President Dick Cheney. But not all members blamed the Bush administration. Blame was also placed on the Congress for lacking oversight and ignoring crimes from a small number of agencies that were skeptical of the evidence. Carl Ford was former Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence and Research.
It starts with letting us get away with mediocrity. Demand excellence instead. Don't settle for the crap we usually give you. You are blessed with an exceptionally talented workforce, and you have been generous in giving them the resources they need to do their job. Now you must insist that we perform up to our potential and hold us accountable when we don't. Otherwise, the chances we will do better the next time aren't very good.
This is the first hearing the Democratic Policy Committee has held on the issue nearly 4 years after the intelligence claims. No Republican senators chose to attend. But one Republican was present, a member of the House of Representatives, Walter Jones, from North Carolina and critic of the war. A spokesperson for Senator John Kyle, chair of the Republican Policy Committee, said that they are aware of the hearings and will be watching them closely. The hearing consisted of only dissenters to the war policy, none in support. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
An investigation by the Los Angeles Times has concluded that 50,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed since the start of the Iraq War. In 2004, a Johns Hopkins study published in the British medical journal The Lancet estimated the Iraqi civilian death toll at over 100,000. That number was considered conservative because it excluded the toll in Fallujah, one of the hardest-hit cities of the invasion. The Los Angeles Times estimate was based on statistics from the Baghdad Morgue, the Iraqi Health Ministry, and other agencies. Their figure is at least 20,000 more than the Bush administration has publicly acknowledged.
Embedded journalist Dar Jamal reports this week that 1.5 years after the November 2004 U.S. military assault on Fallujah, residents tell of ongoing suffering, lack of jobs, and little reconstruction in the continuing violence. The city remains under draconian biometric security, with retinal scans, fingerprinting, and x-raying required for anyone entering the city. Not even residents of the surrounding towns and villages, which fall under Fallujah's administrative jurisdiction, are allowed in. Across the Euphrates River from the city sits Fallujah General Hospital. Built in 1964, the hospital was unable to function during the sieges by U.S. forces because it was being occupied by the U.S. military. Although a new hospital is under construction, the medical personnel told Jamal that supplies are so short that most people will be dead by the time it's built. The new mayor recently announced his resignation, saying, quote, "The Americans did not fulfill their promises to me, so I resign."
One of two Navy pilots whose jet fighters collided over a Central California military base has been found seriously injured. A second pilot died in the incident. A military spokesman says two parachutes were seen after the single-seat fighters crashed, indicating both pilots ejected. Navy spokesman Dennis McGrath says the jets were on a training flight from Lemoore Naval Air Station, about 90 miles east of the collision site. The planes went down over Fort Hunter Liggett, a huge Army Reserve base 150 miles south of San Francisco. The cause crashed several small fires. Lemoore supplies all the fighter jets to the Navy ships off the West Coast and serves as a training site for FA-18 fighter jets.
President George Bush slammed last week's disclosure in the New York Times of a government program to monitor international financial transactions. Yesterday, Republican Congressman Peter King called for a criminal prosecution of all New York Times staff responsible for the publication of the report about the financial monitoring program. Although the two other national newspapers ran the articles on the program on Friday, the New York Times has received the bulk of Representative King's criticism. The New York congressman, which serves as chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, said the Times broke the law and compromised national security by publishing the report. Back in December, the New York Times broke the story of another controversial surveillance operation, that of a massive NSA program to wiretap telephone and email communications without a court order. Lawsuits questioning the legality of the warrantless wiretapping program have already begun.
Arizona's Senator John McCain's Senate Bill 1003 would finish the relocation process of the remaining Navajo from land on the Black Mesa Hopi Navajo Reservation. The bill passed the Senate unanimously last month and is under consideration in the House Resources Committee. The Navajo, faced with relocation, oppose the bill and say relocation would strip them of their way of life. Since 1974, over 15,000 Navajo and 100 Hopi have been displaced from their ancestral homes in Arizona due to an alleged land dispute between the two tribes. But opponents say that the Navajo are being moved off their land so coal companies can mine it. The Bureau of Indian Affairs estimates that less than a few hundred Navajo remain on Black Mesa, and John McCain's bill would require their imminent removal by 2008. But the remaining Navajo refuse to be moved. Christina Anastad reports.
Many Navajo say they are being forced off their coal-rich land so companies can mine it. Opponents of relocation say attorney John Boyden drafted the original relocation bill, the 1974 Navajo-Hopi Land Settlement Act, while he was working for the Hopi Tribal Council and Peabody Coal at the same time. 85-year-old Rena Lane refuses to be moved from her homeland.
This land here was made by Creator, and I have a belief that this is my mother and this is my father. This is my ways of life. I love the land. I have to fight for it, and this is the only thing I have besides my culture and my ways of life. I can't go to another place and have a land, and over there, there's nothing free. Where would I go? There's nothing. That's the reason why I have to live here, and that's why I have to fight here.
As Senate Bill 1003 waits in the House Resources Committee, Peabody Coal, the world's largest coal company, waits for a permit to expand their Black Mesa and Kayenta mines into land the Navajo say is theirs. Peabody Coal is a major Bush contributor, according to Public Citizen. Its CEO, Earl Englehart, contributed $100,000 to Bush's 2004 presidential campaign. Englehart later served as an advisor to Bush's 2005 energy plan, which includes a $2 billion investment in the coal industry over the next 10 years. This month, Bush appointed former Peabody coal manager John Correll to head the Office of Surface Mining, where Peabody is waiting for its permit to expand its two mines. Leonard Benally, a Navajo resistor, says the Navajo are being forced off their land so mineral companies can mine it.
To get at the mineral interests, which was coal, oil, a few people are living off the luxury of the misery and the death of the people out here. Because out here in these hills, we don't have electricity or no running water. But then we now should say we own Las Vegas, because all the neon lights and all, you know, the powers that they get for their casinos and all that, the electricity is generated from Black Mesa and Laughlin, Nevada. And then it goes into Southern California.
Peabody Coal has also contributed over $64,000 since 1998 to members on the House Resources Committee, where SB 1003 is waiting for a vote. But both the Hopi and Navajo tribal governments dispute any connection between coal and relocation. The Hopi Tribal Council supports SB 1003, but the Navajo Nation opposes the bill because it would close the Navajo-Hopi Indian Relocation Office, which provides benefits to those who relocate. George Hardeen, spokesperson for the Navajo Nation, says hundreds of families who have relocated have not yet received their benefits. He says there needs to be a program to offset the adverse effects of relocation.
Relocation has resulted in unemployment for a lot of people. It's resulted in alcoholism among many people who never drank before. It's broken up families. It's taken people who have raised livestock their entire lives and placed them in communities where they can't have any livestock at all. It has led to impoverishment, just a dislocation from the land that had been their home for many generations. As a result, it's created great stress, and that's resulted in health problems of all kinds.
At last week's House Resources Committee hearing, Arizona Congressmember Rick Renzi said he is considering alternative legislation to investigate the effects of relocation and continue funding for the displaced Navajo. Meanwhile, the resisting Navajo families at Black Mesa refuse to be moved. For FSRN, I'm Christina Anastad at Black Mesa, Arizona.
The top official at the University of Colorado's flagship campus said today he intends to fire embattled Professor Ward Churchill. The charges stem from alleged academic misconduct. They were filed after controversial remarks Churchill made after the 9/11 attacks in the World Trade Center. In an essay written shortly after 2001 terrorist attacks, Churchill described some of the victims of the World Trade Center as little Eichmanns, a reference to Holocaust architect Adolf Eichmann. The essay was largely ignored until January 2005, when it came to light before Churchill was to speak at Hamilton College in upstate New York. The essay triggered calls for Churchill to be fired, but a university official concluded he could not be dismissed because of free speech protections. Now, the school's Committee on Research Misconduct said Churchill has committed, quote, has committed serious, repeated, and deliberate research misconduct. The interim chancellor, Philip DeStefano, said Churchill has 10 days to appeal the decision to a faculty committee. Churchill, a tenured professor of ethnic studies, has denied the allegations of plagiarism and other misconduct and said he would file suit if fired.
The newly established UN Human Rights Council is holding its inaugural session in Geneva. The meeting, set to last through the end of the month, brings together high-level representatives from over 100 countries, many of whom hope that the new council will make its mark on history by adopting, at its first session, the Declaration of the Human Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Despite some progress over the last decade, indigenous people around the world continue to live in hardship and danger due to the failure of states to uphold their fundamental human rights. Danuta Safraniak reports from New York.
It is estimated that there are 2 million Indians living in the U.S. The Oneida Nation stretches from eastern New York to Buffalo. It represents a population of 50 to 70,000 and is the founding member of the Six Nations Confederacy. Ray Halberger is the representative of Oneida Indian Nation.
Indian nations, they're trying to retain it so they can determine their own futures for themselves. They're constantly in a tension with the state and local and federal governments about their exercise of sovereignty, of protecting their own borders, their land, natural resources, protecting sacred and religious objects, their ability to have education, to preserve their language. It's a constant state of tension.
Many Indian leaders point to the fact that indigenous peoples in America are still uprooted from their lands and communities as a consequence of government policies or private economic interests. Susan Sean Harjo, Cheyenne and Haldalji Muskogee, is the president of the Morningstar Institute in Washington.
Most of our lands were stolen, and so it's absolutely proper to try to recover property. I'm proud that I've been part of efforts that have resulted in 1 million acres going back to Native nations, including many sacred places.
Indian nations in the U.S. are constantly being denied rights to their traditional lands. Stephen Newcomb is the co-founder of Indigenous Law Institute and representative of Shoshone Nation inhabiting the state of Nevada. He mentions that recently the U.N. Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination received credible information alleging that the Western Shoshone are being denied their traditional rights to land, while the measures taken by the state may lead to irreparable harm to these communities.
They have a treaty with the United States from 1863, and according to that treaty, their territory consists of some 60 million acres, and the United States government has been attempting to force a payment on them of 15 cents an acre to say, here, you have to take this money, and then you have no more land rights. However, there's no documented evidence that their land had ever been taken from them. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights also found that the United States is violating the human rights of the Western Shoshone Nation.
The indigenous peoples hope that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples will finally be adopted by the Council. I'm Danuta Shafranets, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
In a breakthrough for advocates of whistleblowers' rights, the Senate last week approved an amendment that would tighten up the protections for federal employees who expose waste, fraud, abuse, and threats to public safety. A bipartisan group of senators led by Daniel K. Akaka, Democrat of Hawaii, won unanimous consent last week to include the amendment in the fiscal 2007 Defense Authorization Bill. The amendment was based on a whistleblower bill introduced by Akaka last year. The Akaka amendment would permit federal employees to claim whistleblower protection for any disclosure they make of wrongdoing. The 1989 Whistleblower Protection Act sought to protect federal employees from reprisals and retribution for speaking out on waste, fraud, and abuse inside the government. But the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has ruled that federal employees have no protection for disclosures made to immediate superiors or coworkers, for statements made in connection with their normal employment duties, or for statements of publicly known facts. The U.S. Supreme Court has also recently denied whistleblowers First Amendment free speech rights.
Federal authorities are increasingly using DNA tests in Los Angeles and other cities to confirm the identities of certain would-be immigrants. Companies that perform the exam say testing is done in cases where U.S. citizens or green card holders sponsor people they allege are close relatives to immigrate legally. Jack Anderson, a director at Andergene Labs in Oceanside, says companies like his are called in when missing birth, marriage, school, or medical certificates raise flags for authorities. The tests are voluntary, but petitions may be rejected if applicants refuse to take them. L.A. immigration lawyer Aggie Hoffman says she advises their clients to cooperate. But others say the tests can cost $700 to $800 and are prohibitively expensive. Immigration and State Department officials insist DNA testing is used infrequently.
The city of Washington, D.C. is to launch a campaign this week to test every resident aged between 14 and 84 for the HIV virus. The initiative is part of a plan to make HIV testing as routine as having a blood pressure check. It is expected that Washington residents will know their HIV status by the end of December 2006. Washington has America's worst rate of new HIV transmission. About 1 in 50 residents is believed to be HIV positive.
People around the country are outraged at proposed energy bills and policies as the House of Representatives embarks on its Energy Week today. Some are calling for real solutions to the energy problems, both domestically and internationally. D.C. Radio Co-op's Raimi Kahuta in Washington, D.C. reports.
Welcome to Wasted Energy Week.
This was supposed to be the time when the U.S. government was supposed to listen to the American people, adds Carl Pope, the executive director of the Sierra Club, at the news conference on the Hill today, whereby five national environmental advocacy groups called for real solutions from the House, trying to appease the popular outrage over increasing oil prices and threats of yet another war. Carl Pope.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission just licensed in New Mexico a facility for the reprocessing of uranium, which we have indicated we would consider going to war with Iran if they were to undertake the same activities using the same technology.
Meanwhile, the United States House Resource Committee passed an offshore oil and gas drilling bill as a nationwide survey released this week by the Zogby International Polling Firm documents that nearly three-quarters of the respondents say Congress' priority should be passing legislation that promotes renewable energy and better fuel economy for cars.
As Americans prepare to celebrate Independence Day, one thing they won't be cheering is Congress's continued dependence on big oil.
Ana Origo, the legislative director of the United States Public Interest Group, the National Lobbying Office of the State Public Interest Research Groups, says there are solutions to the problem and it's time to implement them.
Many, many, many different economists and scientists have shown through many, many studies that America has the technological know-how to build cars and trucks that can go much further on a gallon of gasoline. And we should do this, and we should set this in stone by raising gas mileage standards. If we were to get to 40 miles per gallon in 10 years, we could save 3 million barrels of oil a day.
This can save more than the Persian Gulf imports and the potential Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and California oil production combined, adds Orillo. Yet the United States administration is still pushing drilling bills which ignore environmental concerns and circumvent state and federal legislation while aggressively promoting nuclear power as a clean non-carbon dioxide energy source. Cindy Shogun of Alaska Wilderness League says that the American public is not fooled by any drilling scans and are mobilized to increase the heat this summer.
And this summer, Americans across the country are going to declare their energy independence. From sea to shining sea, there will be beach events coordinated by the Sierra Club to protect our coastal waters, rig-free, all over our coasts. And this Wednesday at over 280 gas stations, citizens will be demanding that Congress be oil-free, and this is a campaign coordinated by MoveOn.org. And then U.S. PERF is demanding that Congress acknowledge and recognize and actually act on global warming, and their Earth on Fire may be in a city near you. And we're going to ask Secretary Ken Thorne to stay out of the Western Arctic. He's supposed to offer a lease sale in September, and we're telling him no.
With Fred Nguyen of WBAI, I'm Reem Katkhuda, DCRadioCoop.org.
Workers are using fire hoses to pump water out of the National Archives after heavy rain caused widespread flooding in the nation's capital. The building is home to the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and other historical documents. But the Archives spokeswoman Susan Cooper reports that all records and national treasures are safe and dry. Flooding has closed several other federal buildings, including the Internal Revenue Service, the Commerce Department, and the Justice Department. Some of the Smithsonian museums are also closed. The results of more than 7 inches of rainfall caused havoc during the morning commute. A mudslide forced a partial closure of the Capitol Beltway, and high water disrupted subways and rail lines. An elm tree that was at least 100 years old fell near the front door of the White House. But the National Park Service says the tree has been grounded in the mulch and will be replaced next week.
The current time is 5:44. And now, time for another commentary by Jim Hightower.
Good grief. In just 5 years, the Bushites have gone from mere zealotry to loopiness, and now to inhumanity. Since 2002, they've held some 460 Iraqi, Afghan, and other men in an autocratic, illegal netherworld called Gitmo, a hellhole of a prison on a military base in Cuba. Even though it's clear that many of these men, and maybe most, are not guilty of terrorist plotting, the Bushites have asserted an imperious presidential right to hold and even torture the prisoners indefinitely, ruthlessly operating Gitmo as an executive dungeon that they claim is not accountable to Congress, the courts, or we the people. Secret military tribunals sit in judgment of these prisoners, who are essentially held incommunicado and denied any process to prove their innocence. Deprived of all hope, dozens of these detainees have been resorting to suicide attempts, and three are now dead. The world sees Gitmo and these suicides as a stark admission that the U.S. has abandoned its historic role as a moral beacon for the protection of human rights. That's bad, but worse, the Bushites have openly mocked the dead. The honcho of Gitmo, Rear Admiral Harry Harris, immediately branded these three suicides, quote, an act of asymmetrical warfare against us. Excuse me, Admiral, but I think it's your humanity that's gone asymmetrical on you. Next came Colleen Graffey, an Assistant Secretary of State. In a slap at the Islamic men who had just taken their own lives, she breezily declared that their suicides were nothing but, quote, a good PR move to advance the terrorist cause. This is Jim Hightower saying, believe it or not, this lady is the Assistant Secretary for Public Diplomacy, a new office created by Bush to try to improve America's world image, especially in Islamic countries. Yet Bush has made no move to reprimand Graffey, much less fire her. What kind of diplomatic message does that send to the Islamic world? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Independent Native News, following our newscast, and at 6 p.m. here, Labor Radio. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Critical heat advisory for all of the Willamette Valley in southwest Washington and Columbia Gorge. Highs in the triple digits until at least 7 p.m. on Tuesday. You're listening to KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Hood River.
A massive number of Israeli soldiers backed by military vehicles have gathered on the Gaza border and are poised to enter if an agreement for the release of an Israeli soldier captured by Palestinian militants is not reached. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has publicly ruled out negotiating with the captors, who issued a demand today for Israel to release about 100 women and 300 minors currently jailed. Aside from the soldier who was captured, at least three Palestinian resistance fighters and two Israeli soldiers were killed in the early Sunday morning attack launched by Palestinian resistance groups at the military post of Kerem Shalom near the southern Gaza Strip. Manar Jabrin reports.
The attack was carried out by fighters from three different Palestinian resistance groups, including Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of the ruling Hamas party, the Popular Resistance Committees, and a previously unknown group calling itself the Islamic Army. Abu Ubaida, spokesperson of Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, said that this operation came in response to the Israeli policies against the Palestinian people.
This operation is a new non-traditional operation that involved huge security and military preparations. The Zionist enemy is responsible for the results of this operation because it came as a response to Israel's criminal policies and the ongoing killing and assassinations of our people.
About the abduction of the soldier, Abu Ubaida says,
We have no information or details to release about the Israeli soldier to the Zionist enemy until this moment.
In response, the Israeli army tightened security around the Gaza Strip, while the Navy increased patrols along the Gaza coast in an effort to prevent fighters from smuggling the abducted soldier out of the Gaza Strip. The army also requested that Egyptian security forces seal the Philadelphia route in the southern part of the Gaza Strip and begin additional operations along the borders between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. The army is reportedly preparing for a possible large-scale ground offensive in the Gaza Strip. Dozens of tanks and armored vehicles, infantry corps and engineering corps and other forces have been positioned near the Gaza border since Sunday evening around the Gaza Strip. Saleh Al-Naami, a Palestinian political analyst of the Israeli Affairs, says,
there is a decision that is already taken by Prime Minister Ehud Olmert himself to carry out a massive operation in Gaza. This operation may include occupying the locations in which the Israeli soldier may be held. We know that Israel had previously threatened to carry out such military operations, even before this recent attack by the Palestinian resistance. Israel had threatened to carry out these operations in response to the Palestinian resistance firing homemade shells on Israel.
The Israeli government held the Palestinian Authority responsible for the safety of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit and gave the Palestinians 48 hours to return him. None of the Palestinian factions who took part in Sunday's attack officially claimed responsibility for the abduction of the Israeli soldier. Later on Monday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas ordered his security services to launch a wide range of searches for the abducted soldier. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni held a series of meetings with 60 of international diplomats in an attempt to put pressure on the Palestinian Authority to release the kidnapped soldier. Also, an Egyptian and French mediators took part in the negotiations in this issue. In a statement sent to local Gaza outlets and signed by three resistance groups responsible for the attack, said that they would release information of the soldier if Israel released Palestinian women and minors under 18 years old held in the Israeli jails. At least 123 women and 313 minors are currently held in the Israeli jails. Israel's government reiterated its stance, no negotiations with the Palestinian resistance groups on its soldier. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Bethlehem, Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
East Timor's Prime Minister Mari Alkatiri said today he is ready to resign. The announcement marks the end of a political showdown between Alkatiri and President Xanana Guzman, who on Thursday had threatened to resign if the Prime Minister did not leave office. Alkatiri's decision to fire some 600 disgruntled soldiers earlier this year is widely seen as a catalyst for the country's current political crisis. Fredlin, the Prime Minister's political party, will name his replacement.
The huge pledges of aid, debt relief, and trade reforms that were promised at last year's G8 conference at Glen Eagles, Scotland, have not been delivered, according to a report by ActionAid. British Prime Minister Tony Blair claimed a moral and political victory in the negotiations, which led to the challenging cancelling of debt for the 18 poorest countries in the world, as well as a doubling of the aid budget, better access to HIV drugs, and fundamental reform of the U.S. and EU subsidy systems. ActionAid's report, entitled Mission Unaccomplished, says millions of lives are still being lost in Africa and the rest of the developing world by the failure of Western countries to live up to the favorable headlines generated by the summit. The charity is calling for the millions of people who supported the Make Poverty History campaign to use the first anniversary to increase pressure on the government over the failed pledges. And that wraps up the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 26th. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Tonight's audio editor, Jacob Fenston. Special thanks to reporter Jacob Fenston. Our engineer is Eve Sokolai. And the evening news and public affairs director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News.